This is Christian Robillard, and you're listening to Beyond the Bake Sale, where we help you raise more time, talent, and treasure in innovative, creative, and effective ways for the causes you care about. Leah, welcome to the show. It's so wonderful to see your face and have you back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be invited back. It must have gone okay the first time to get invited back.
I think you had one of our higher listened to episodes in the very early days when we were doing it over Google Hangouts and plugging in a bunch of gizmos and gadgets. And now we live in a world where we're basically right back where we started to a certain degree. So it's interesting times for sure.
In so many respects. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, I imagine you get a lot of these types of messages, whether it's just from friends or colleagues or even some perhaps publications you subscribe to. But have you come across any, intro lines or anything like that, that either hasn't used the word unprecedented or has used a better way of looking at that unprecedented? I know I was watching some friends this morning literally post up a picture from a thesaurus saying that instead of using unprecedented, maybe you can use some of these words instead.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think we are using a few words quite a lot. The other one is pivot. You know, everyone's talking about pivoting, unprecedented. But I read an interesting opinion. I think it may have been this morning. Someone saying, we're getting sick of those words, but our donors aren't. So, mm-hmm. You know, and that's basically true for all fundraising and nonprofit communications. Is just as we're getting sick of saying whatever it is we're saying is about when donors start to hear it. I'm sick of those words, but others aren't.
And it's definitely, hopefully it's not a beating a horse to death at this point. And again, as you mentioned, just because it's annoying for us doesn't mean it's annoying for others. And I think we get so saturated with it. So it's good to hear that that's not necessarily the case on the other side. But yeah. Otherwise, how are things going in your world? Is everyone in your household faring okay and healthy and dealing with things as best as they can?
Yeah, I think we're doing okay. But of course, like everybody else, it was a bit of a process over a number of weeks, and it very much matched the stages of grieving. So, you know, initially it was just like, I think all of us just felt a little bit of shock as we tried to wrap our heads around this. And then certainly there was a good week where we were all just really down. And then my husband got laid off temporarily. So that threw us for another loop for a few days. But I'd say in the last week to 10 days, we've kind of gotten into our groove. And a really odd thing has happened to me. You know, as you and I've spoken about before, I live with PTSD. And so, you know, typically my anxiety is very high and it's been like that for decades. I'm actually feeling really mentally well during this. I'm part of the small percentage of people with anxiety who feel better during this crisis. And I think...
Interesting.
Yeah. I think it's because so many things are out of my control that I'm not even worrying about them. And mm-hmm. The hypervigilance that comes with PTSD out there dealing with the world is gone because I'm home and I'm in my safe place. And I've noticed my kids are the same. You know, anxiety is kind of our, you know, family tradition here, all four of us. And my kids are the same. And it's because, you know, they're not having to confront a lot of the things that make them anxious. So we're in a good space, really. And it's sort of surprising where we've landed because there were a few weeks there where I thought, you know, this could go either way.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because I think it's perhaps the lack of stimuli that are hitting you from every single angle. And if you aren't being one of those religiously watching the news type people who watch the daily press conference, I know I'm definitely guilty of that on a few occasions, but if you're not watching that and listening to all the other kind of echo chambers of some of the similar facts, I feel like that can also help to drop some of the stimuli that might cause some of those feelings of anxiety and depression and grief and things of that nature.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I guess I also benefit from having lived with these disorders for 30 plus years. I have all the tools. So, you know, I know that it's a really good idea to turn off the news when bad stuff's going on in the world, for example. And I know when to take a break and, you know, understand the feelings I start to get when it's time to just go for a walk or something. So so one of the things I've been doing over the last number of weeks and going forward through this month is talking a lot to other people about their mental health, because I can share my own experience and what has worked with me, and hopefully give other people a few tools and a bit of knowledge that will ease the burden for them.
Absolutely. And do you find that, generally speaking, when you talk to folks about this particular topic, which we'll get into in a good amount of detail in just a moment, but do you find that folks have either a good apprehension of how to deal with some of their own mental health challenges, or even self-diagnosing, not to the degree that a medical professional might be able to, but at least being able to recognize some of the signs and symptoms, or even knowing kind of like where to start with thinking about how to take care of themselves from a mental health perspective?
Yes and no. I think those who have had to manage some of these things in the past certainly would recognize those feelings returning. But, you know, my observation is that a lot of people are feeling things that are so unfamiliar, and they haven't tied that necessarily to what's going on. And so one of the things I've been doing is saying, you know, you likely feel this, whatever, five or six things. And this is why you're feeling it. And then I'll get people saying, oh, that's what's going on. That's
more of like a reactionary type thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
like, oh, you put those words to it, and those are my words, so now I understand, versus I have no idea this huge influx of feelings and what I'm experiencing right now.
Yeah. Like, why am I nauseous all the time? Why am I getting headaches? Or why am I either exhausted or not sleeping? Some combination of that. And you know, all of those are super normal and expected things to feel when you're going through it, and I'll call it what it is. It's a traumatic experience for all of us.
Yeah. I was having some conversations with a friend of mine last night, and he was talking about how he just doesn't feel himself. And I was like, this is grief. Like, this is a straight up feeling of grief. Like, you have a loss over something that you have no control over, and you wish that you could do something to move the needle on it or to be able to rectify it, but it's just not possible at this point in time. Or there's small things you can do, but a bit of an understanding that you kind of have to let the wave wash over you a bit, and then, you know, reorient yourself is important.
Yeah. And I think really the key is understanding that it's totally normal and expected. You know, that's certainly something that's probably been the single most powerful message to me over the decades. You know, I used to frame things as, I don't know why I react to such and such in that weird way, or I don't know why that just, I had the opposite response to whatever. I kind of framing that and saying, you know what, actually, it's not abnormal. And this would be a therapist talking to me. It's not abnormal. It's perfectly normal that you react the way you do because of your past experiences. And that's the same that holds true here is, you know, if we're kind of bursting out in anger, and we're not usually like that, or we just can't think straight, you know, it's so hard to focus. None of that is abnormal. It's totally normal in a pandemic. So yeah, that makes me feel better, just understanding that, you know, it would be way stranger to be feeling exactly normal as you always do, right? And feel nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, without a doubt. And then for you, Leah, at what point, I guess, in your career did you learn or start to put together, whether it's the words or the advice or the thought patterns around, how can I use this to help other people deal with some of their challenges? Obviously, not coming from a medical background, there's certain amounts of lengths that you can go to try to help people. But was there a point in your career where you said, you know what, it's best for me and for the peers around me to start talking about some of these things, and here's the way that I think that I can do it?
The journey really started probably 10 years ago in just sort of thinking about it and playing with the idea that I might want to, you know, take more of an advocacy role. But I didn't actually do it until about 3 years ago. And, you know, I'm sort of like that. I spend a long time thinking about a decision before I actually make it, especially a big one like that. To me, it felt like a big decision to kind of go public. And about 3 years ago, I was working with a coach who, through her questioning and the little exercises we would do, it came out of me, myself, that the public me and the private me weren't in alignment. And that didn't feel good. It kind of gave me that icky feeling in my gut that can come when you're not feeling like you're showing up as your authentic self. And so she encouraged me to speak out, and I knew I could. I could do that from a safe place because I don't have a boss. I'm my own boss, and I have a really wonderful group of clients. You know, if anyone had a issue with it, they probably wouldn't be my client anyway. So I started with this like little LinkedIn post on a Sunday night when I thought no one would look at it. And it was a case study from the Harvard Business Review about an employee living with mental illness and how would you manage that? So I kind of put that up there. And then really at the bottom, I said, I'm interested in this because I live with PTSD. And the response I got was amazing. Mostly private messages from people saying, me too, or you're so brave. And that encouraged me to just keep going. So, you know, since that time, I've done a number of conference sessions on it, both at the international, national, and local level. And it seems to always be well received. And I guess it's probably because, you know, I do have a platform to talk about this, and I'm in a safe place, so I can talk on behalf of all of those who can't speak out, who aren't in a safe place or feeling stigma. And that's a really nice feeling. It really feels like giving back. And it is giving back to a certain extent. I mean, there's nothing in it for me other than trying to uplift other people. So as we all know, that kind of altruism feels good.
And being a pioneer in this space, are there certain things that you're starting to see that, I guess, are shifting the scales more in favor of people feeling like they're accepted and be able to talk about these things more openly in a way that gives you some type of I guess, hope for the future in terms of people feeling comfortable coming forward and saying, you know, I have these mental health challenges and this is how it affects me in my day to day. And I either want people to understand me or to have help or something along those lines.
Yeah. I think for sure, you know, there's, on the one hand, there's huge generational differences in talking about this. So I think of, you know, I'm 52. I think of my late grandmother. She would, I know because she did it, never talk about this stuff. It had been in our family, and she just, nope, you don't even talk about it. You sweep it under the rug. Then there's my parents' generation who are a little more open to it and understanding me, that it took me 50 years to do it. And then my kids who are teenagers now and speak really openly about their mental health, and so do all their peers. So partly that generational shift is impacting how we talk about it. But I think also having corporations and organizations and associations starting to offer tools and initiating discussions is making a big difference. I think of the Association of Fundraising Professionals in particular, who in 2020 have kind of this mini focus. They've, you know, a number of mini focuses is on self-care and mental health. And, you know, 5 years ago, that would not seem to like a possibility, but it's been really well received. And there's a huge need for it. I did a webinar in December for them, and it had the highest attendance of any webinar they've ever done on the topic of mental health. So clearly there is a need out there that, you know, needs to be addressed.
Without a doubt. And do you think that there's, I'm trying to think of the best way to frame this, but whether it's for all industries or for the fundraising profession more specifically, do you think there's a reason that it's taken, I guess, this long, or hasn't mental health as something to do to things to do for your mental health haven't risen to the prominence that perhaps they should have? Do you think there's a reasoning, whether it is some of those pieces around generational divides or something else altogether? Do you think there's a reason for why it hasn't risen in prominence or in importance in professional opinion up until this point?
I think part of the reason is that it's only been in the last 5 to 10 years that research has started coming out and case studies showing that if corporations or organizations address the mental health of their staff, their bottom line is grows. Their stakeholder engagement's better. Their staff are more productive. They'll bring in more revenue because there are fewer missed work days and so on. So I think to a certain extent, dollars talk, right? So as it was discovered through tracking all sorts of different companies that you know, this actually increases your net at the end of the day by investing in this upfront. Of course, that's going to speak to people who are focused on either fundraising and bringing in revenue or corporate profits and shareholders.
And not to put you on the spot, but do you have in your mind a few of those metrics that have really stood out for you, whether it's in your very brief kind of or researching in this area and preparing for presentations or just hearing them from different organizations who have tracked some of these things? Are there any that particularly stand out at you as either like, wow, that's impressive, or oh my goodness, I can't believe we haven't been doing this for longer because of these results clearly speak for themselves?
Yeah, I'm terrible at keeping stats in my head, but there is one and I won't get it exactly right. So this is, you know, roughly, I may be.
That is quite all right.
I might be off by a part of a percent, but one of the ones that really stood out for me was that for every dollar invested in the mental health of employees, there's a $4 return. That's pretty big, right? If you look, if you're looking at big numbers, and it's plus or minus 50 cents, but a significant return. And you know, that speaks volumes, really. No wonder companies are kind of the companies who are paying attention to this stuff and seeing this research come out. It's no wonder that they're starting to address this.
Without a doubt. And I imagine a big part of being able to address on a more systemic level challenges around mental health are having good allies who are around you to either help you point out certain things or you be able to seek help yourself. So I want to bounce around a little bit. And the first part I want to talk about is within yourself. So within yourself, are there certain, whether it's from your personal experience or from chatting with people who have participated in some of these webinars or chatting with peers in the space, are there certain things that you look for in yourself or they look for themselves that can say, oh, maybe I do have one of these challenges that I need to address, or maybe this is something that's bothering me that isn't, you know, business as usual, or I guess common, or something that I can just kind of like brush it off or sweep under the rug, as I think your reference put it. Are there things that people can look out for or things they should be recognizing so they can address them in due course?
For sure. I think probably the biggest one is if whatever you're feeling inside is getting in the way of your enjoyment of life, then there's something to, look into. If you're unproductive at work, if your relationships are strained, you know, that's usually one of the first signs. And there are lots of tools out there, which I direct people to. CAMH in Toronto, for example, has a tool, right? It's actually on, they've got a special page for COVID-19 mental health resources, and they've got a little quiz you can do that will kind of, you know, pop back an answer about how severe your anxiety might be or your depressed feelings, that sort of thing. So there's lots of tools out there now that where we can do a little self-assessment and check in. And we can also rely on friends and family to, you know, hopefully just, you know, put a hand on our shoulder, maybe not right now with social distancing, but just say, you know what, you're really quiet, or, you know, I noticed you haven't shown up for the last few, whatever, Zoom calls, things like that. So we need to watch out for each other as well.
And I'd like to put a bit of a pin in that one around the friends and family piece, because I think there's a lot to unpack there. But with regards to, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts and videos and reading articles. And I'm sure this has been a similar situation for you. There's been this whole conversation, particularly in these times of having to deal with social distancing and working from home and effectively working under pandemic level conditions, that the whole productivity question is really coming up. And I imagine, and as we just talked about, you know, the productivity piece is one that tends to suffer under if you're having challenges with your mental health. But I imagine some people too might misdiagnose themselves and say, oh, well, maybe I just need to work harder, or it's my fault because I'm not being as productive. Do you have any thoughts around that whole dynamic between maybe you do need to work more, work harder, something along those lines to be more productive, versus this is something that I need to take care of myself for and think about and pay a little bit more attention to make sure that I can overcome these things?
Yeah, good question. That whole idea of productivity, and I actually tell people to steer away from productivity porn, I call it. That's, you know.
Productivity porn. Oh my.
Well, you know, if you go on any website, or, you know, any news website or online anywhere, or, you know, you go on Amazon and there's journals and productivity books and videos and courses, and that puts a huge amount of pressure on people. So, you know, I always recommend stay away from it. A big part of managing anxiety, well, in managing, even if you don't have anxiety, is developing a bit of a schedule and having a bit of discipline, and particularly if you're now working from home. So, you know, making sure you add a bit of exercise into your day and that it's actually on your agenda. They have adequate breaks, that you take some time for some deep breathing if you need it. And after developing that little schedule for yourself, if you find you can't stick to it, like you can barely get yourself out of bed, it's probably time to reach out to a medical professional. I also think, I mean, I feel grateful because I've got teenagers who can kind of take care of themselves during the day, but I can't imagine trying to navigate this while trying to get in 9-to-5 work day. You're also the babysitter, you're also the teacher, you're also the housekeeper. I think you'd be lucky to have one productive hour a day if you're in that situation. And I think employers need to recognize, if they're not experiencing it themselves, like they're like me and the kids are a bit older, they need to just have so much empathy, because you can't expect 8 hours of productivity from somebody working from home during a pandemic. Yes, on normal circumstances, you should expect 7 to 8 hours a day. But during this time, when we're spending so much of our bandwidth trying to figure out how to get groceries, we're dealing with all this stuff we've never had to think about before, and it's exhausting. Suddenly we have to use our critical thinking skills for things that just came naturally before. I wish I could just mandate that nobody worry about their productivity, but I know a lot of people are getting pressure from their leadership or their boss or whatever. But in my mind, you know, if you can do an hour a day, great. One of the things I encourage people to do is to think about a ladder. So, you know, right now you're kind of at the bottom of that ladder, and up at the top of the ladder is that 8 hours of productivity. The kids have jumped 2 grades because you're such a great homeschooler or homeschooler teacher. That's the top of the ladder. And a lot of people are trying to figure out how they go from the bottom rung to the top right away. And really, you need to break down, what does each rung represent? And maybe your first rung each day is just getting out of bed and having a shower. Done. You're done for the day. Congratulations. That's fantastic. But we each need to figure out what that looks like and try to just get rid of that expectation that we're going to go from bottom to top right away.
That's a great analogy. It seems to me, if we're using fundraising language too, it's almost like you have your traditional kind of donor journey to a degree. You have different phases, and never in your right mind would you try to jump a donor from one, let's say phase one or touch point one to touch point six. That doesn't make any sense. So why we would try to do that for ourselves, especially as we're with anything, if you're trying to learn it, you don't jump from like 1 to 7. Maybe you can jump from 1 to 3 or get yourself from 1 to 3. But within that, there's so much that goes into just learning something or progressing in something. So I think that's a great analogy. I wanted to ask, it's a bit of a two-part question. I think bridges us to a different part of the conversation altogether. The first part I wanted to talk about was in the work context for those who are experiencing challenges with their mental health or perhaps starting to feel that struggle and are now coming to that point where they've acknowledged that, yes, I'm having a challenge. It's time for me to reach out. In your opinion and in your experience, what are some suggestions you would give or some advice you would give to those who want to initiate that conversation, be it with a supervisor, your leadership, or even with friends or family that so they can have a bit of, I guess, that peace of mind, or at least go in with a starting point to how to initiate the conversation?
Yeah, it's tricky. It very much depends on leadership. And in an ideal world, the conversation starts at the leadership level. So having a leader, and I don't mean big L leader, but anyone who has some influence, having them start by talking about mental health. It could be as simple as sharing out an article they've read to the rest of the team. It could be sharing their own story if they have one, or the story of someone they know. But having the leadership open up that conversation is more important than ever. I mean, I've advocated for that for a couple of years, but right now it's critical. Doing that will open the door for everyone else at the organization to feel more comfortable in speaking up. Being able to do it in a way that ensures privacy and confidentiality is going to be really big. A lot of times for folks, their family doesn't even know that they're struggling with some of these things. If you do have some policies and manuals, HR policies, it's worth looking through those, because increasingly they include a mental health component, and mental illness classified as it should be, as part of your overall health. I always laugh when people differentiate physical and mental health, because last time I checked, your brain was part of your physical body. So to me, it's all physical health. Those are not easy conversations to have, but there are tools out there that can help. The Canadian Mental Health Association, CAMH, the Royal Ottawa here in town have lots of resources available to help people navigate those conversations. I'm not a medical professional, but I always recommend that touching base with a medical professional. I know for most of us, our family doctors, clinics even will do virtual visits these days. And just talking it through and having someone else know what you're going through, it makes it easier and kind of validates, yes, in fact, there's something going on.
And I think that holistic piece is particularly important, realizing that your entire systems are integrated, much in the same way that your coach first off showed you how that authenticity piece between both of your professional and personal life weren't necessarily linked, and being able to flag that. I think us being able to flag that in ourselves is one of those critical turning points to say, okay, now we can start a bit on this road to recovery and say that there's this whole holistic system that we need to consider, and not just, everything is compartmentalized. This part of my life can't possibly affect this part if I just choose, put it in this little box and put it off to the side. You have to let it open and understand how it has implications for the rest of your life. So I think that's a valuable takeaway that I'm taking right now.
Yeah, well, for sure. And I think having had a business coach and having therapists in my life, they really kind of go at it from the same angle, which is to draw out of you or help you internally untangle all the knots that are in there. They're not giving you the answers. They're in you, but it takes really a professional to kind of be asking the right questions to tease it out for you. And that's like eye-opening. It's like, wow, that it really was inside me this whole time. I knew how to figure it out. I just couldn't verbalize it.
So I want to come back to that that piece that we pinned a couple minutes ago around the support network. And you started to touch on it with regards to as a leader, smaller within your organization, or as even peers, you know, here are some of the things you can start to do to support those. What would you give in terms of advice for whether it is leadership or peers to either be able to identify if someone's having one of those challenges and be able to intervene, and perhaps some ideal things to start with that intervention if you don't feel entirely comfortable? Because I can imagine it can be intimidating not wanting to say the wrong thing or not wanting to make the situation worse, but feeling a compelling movement to want to help this particular person, I think all us humans are. Which, what would you have to say around, I guess, that big question?
Yeah, it's really active listening and active observation are kind of the key. Because for someone who's not going to speak out without a little prompting, you have to be able to see those cues. So, you know, one thing I love about all these Zoom meetings is that we're actually seeing people. And by seeing someone, you can, you know, are they looking withdrawn? Are they a little disheveled? Are they, you know, just not their usual self? Sometimes you can see that, not necessarily hear it. And so, you know, watching for some of those things, people not behaving as you are used to them behaving is a sign. And you know, it could start as simple as just sending some resources out to your whole group, right? Not targeting one person in particular, but sending around some resources, reminding them, you know, if you're a leader, what some of their health benefits might be around this area. Having one-on-ones, so not relying completely on big group meetings, but even just calling someone. You don't need to have the perfect words or the perfect answers, but just saying, hey, you know, you were a little quiet on our last call, just checking in, how are you doing? That's a really legitimate question to ask people these days, no matter how they're feeling, because all of us are going through stuff. And so, you know, if you do that in a really kind, empathetic way, you're more likely to get them voicing any concerns or issues they're having.
And in those situations, the thing I find that I often struggle with is how much do you push and how much do you probe and how deep do you go? You know, there's asking how you're doing, and then there's kind of doing those subsequent follow-ups and pushing to see whether there's actually something there or not. How do you respond to something like that? Like, what is the appropriate amount to dive in, or even what are some of those questions to ask that start to unlock some of the answers that hopefully you're hoping for, or some of the responses that you're trying to get out of that person? Anything, what would you have to say around that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, as I always say, we're not medical professionals, so we do need to be a little bit cautious. We can't diagnose or give advice that may seem medical, but what we can do is just open that door to conversation. So making sure that person who may be suffering knows that we're available, not expecting them necessarily to reach out. I know I often see folks will post on social media, you know, if you need to talk to someone, I'm here. If someone's really anxious or depressed, they're unlikely to reach out for that. They're kind of self-focused. So picking up the phone and just chatting, saying, hey, you know, I noticed you're a little quiet, or just checking in to see how you're coping. You know, what's going on, how's the family, and just listening for cues that things might not be all right. But it really, it's up to that individual to share with you if they so choose. You know, one thing I would say is if you really are quite concerned about their health, then, you know, call 911 or call, you know, crisis line or whatever. You know, don't hesitate to do that, because they are the professionals who can help if it seems like it's a situation that needs some immediate intervention. And, you know, you can ask. I think of this mental health first aid course that I took that, you know, encouraged the question, Are you feeling suicidal? Do you have a plan? If they say yes, do you have a plan? If they say yes, then 911 right away. It's actually okay to voice that, even though it feels weird and feels intrusive. It's an okay question to ask if you really are that concerned about someone. But just, you know, doing everything you can to ensure that the person who's suffering knows you're available and will not judge and will act with empathy and compassion, they're much more likely to disclose.
And let's say you're not feeling as comfortable to have those conversations, but you are still concerned. Would you have not necessarily a play-by-play, but as close to that as, or even rough steps of how you might suggest someone help to intervene on someone's behalf? Maybe, for example, like they have demonstrated a certain behavior that leads you to believe that there's cause for concern, and you know, you've reached out to them and perhaps they've said something and you don't really know how to have the conversation, but think they could use some help. Is there something that you think that are there steps that you can take to help that person without you having to be the person, I guess, to intervene directly?
Yeah, I think, you know, sharing resources like the crisis line phone number, Kids Help phone number, both of them are extremely active right now. And, you know, just so that you know that person has that information if they should need it. You know, I have in the past, if I knew, you know, a family member, I might just send a quick note saying, hey, I'm just a little concerned. Don't want to go behind anyone's back, but just wanted to let you know that I'm concerned. Doing something like that. Or, you know, having someone just stop by and check in. That's a little harder to do these days, but we can still ring a doorbell and talk from 6 feet away if we need to. So, you know, all of those things I think are helpful.
And I think too, those types of visits would qualify under some of those more essential visits. Like, we want to limit obviously our contact with people, but in a physical sense, but also if it gets to that point, I would imagine that there's some understanding there to be able to intervene, assuming that you obviously both feel safe, or all the parties involved feel safe. So I think we want to all be physically and social distancing, but we also want to make sure that people are taken care of, because we're all in this together.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and we shouldn't hesitate, you know, to call 911 or the non-emergency number just to have someone else go in and check, or just do a bit of a welfare check. We have to remember that, yes, we're dealing with a pandemic right now, but there are other medical conditions that need addressing as well. So we shouldn't be ignoring our mental health, especially if it's really deteriorating. You know, that you don't put that aside because of the pandemic. It still needs to be addressed.
So, as we start to wrap up this conversation, Leah, I'm just mindful of time. Want to ask a question around, you know, I think the popular analogy is you want to make sure that you put on your own oxygen mask first before you help put others on. I think if I were to extrapolate that to the situation, you obviously want to be conscious of taking care of other people during this time, because I think as humans, we want to do that and we have people we care about. But in your opinion, or in what you've seen, what's an appropriate balance between taking care of your immediate needs, obviously, whether it's physically, mentally, in that very holistic sense, and doing the proactive, you know, reaching out to others, taking care of others in those ways, things along those lines? What's your sense around that piece?
I'm a member of the Stability Network, which down in the States. And a stability leader, there's almost 200 of them around the world. And interestingly enough, we had a call earlier today, and there was a piece of advice they gave around being an advocate and storyteller for mental health that I thought was really important. And that is, in their specific example, they're kind of training people to speak up on stage and tell their stories publicly. But they said, only do it if you're well. If you are having a really bad day, they said, call us, we'll find another speaker. Do not get up on that stage. And I think that holds true here too. Help others when you yourself are feeling really strong. So definitely take care of yourself first. We're no good to anyone else if we're suffering. It's a bit contagious, you know, these feelings of anxiety and depression, and we're going to just pass those along and make the situation worse. So make sure you're well enough to help other people.
I think that's a terrific piece of advice. The way I've had something similar phrased to me is, don't practice what you preach, but only preach what you practice. So if you're not in a position to actually practice what you're about to go up on stage or in general do, then it's probably not best for you to be talking about those things. So I think that's a terrific piece of advice for our listeners. Yeah. So Lee, as we wind things down, the last question I wanted to leave this with is, obviously, COVID-19 presents itself with a number of unique challenges in terms of how abnormal the situation is. Are there certain, I guess, differences in how people are exhibiting, whether it's certain, you know, whether it's certain symptoms or things of that nature, obviously non-COVID-19 related, more on the mental health side of things, that are unique or abnormal compared to how certain mental illnesses might manifest themselves in regular times?
Yeah, I guess there are differences. Certainly, you know, I think our next pandemic will be mental health, a mental health epidemic, because these are such unusual times. And so, you know, some of the things I'm seeing or identifying in other people is, one is dissociation. So kind of walking around, if you're walking around feeling like you're just dreaming all of this, that's your brain protecting you from the trauma. And I think we need to name it. This is a traumatic experience for all of us. And how we're predisposed in terms of our mental wellness will impact how it affects us. But, you know, that lack of productivity, the stress, anger, exhaustion, that kind of dreamlike state are all really normal experiences in the face of trauma.
I think that's an interesting point to end on, is just how, I think that is unfortunately a battle that we have to almost fight simultaneous to this one. But it's great that you've been able to share all of this wisdom for us to at least take some baby steps. And we'll make sure we link all of the notes around that we've talked about in terms of resources in our show notes, so that people can have that more readily available to help others, but also be able to help themselves to put on their own oxygen mask, but also be able to put it on for other folks. Leah, before we go, is there anything that people can follow you around, or anything that you're working on currently that people can keep up to date with, or anything along those lines?
Sure. Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, from the mental health perspective, I'm always happy to chat with people, and probably the best way to reach me is my email, which is leah@yourbluecanoe.ca. I have, you know, pre-recorded webinars on this topic that I can share. For the next 2 months, I'm hosting a Friday morning coffee chat where people can just show up and hang out. You don't even have to say anything. It's just companionship and kind of a safe space. And then I also have developed a two-pager, I guess it is, on things you can do to manage your own anxiety. So those are all things people can reach out to me to get copies of, and that's all freely available to whoever needs it.
Wonderful. And we'll make sure we link all of those in the show notes as well, so that people are able to get in touch with you. And for any of our Ottawa listeners, I don't know if the offer for Friday morning coffee extends to people outside of the Ottawa area, but we'll definitely make sure we
Zoom,
link that
so
in.
So anyone can... Coffee by Zoom. Anyone can join in.
Wonderful. I love it. I might have to join myself for a couple sessions. Not a big coffee drinker. So if tea is acceptable, then I'll definitely be there.
For sure. Tea, wine, whatever floats your boat at 9:30 a.m. on a Friday.
It's 11 o'clock somewhere, right? That's the popular saying. I love it. Exactly. Leah, thank you so much for all your sharing today. I think this will be immensely valuable for our listeners, and we're grateful that you took the time under these abnormal, I don't have my thesaurus open in front of me, so I don't have another word for unprecedented right now, but we hope that you stay well, and that we're very grateful for everything that you've been able to share with us. And we hope that you'll also be able to keep your own oxygen mask on while continuing to help others put them on as well.
Thank you, Christian. Always my pleasure to chat with you anytime.
Hey, everyone. Christian here with a few short things before you take off. A big thanks for tuning into another episode of Beyond the Bake Sale. Did you love the episode? Then we'd be grateful for a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Don't want to miss our next episode? Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Want to collaborate on something? Have a story that you want to tell? Have feedback for us? Then shoot us a message by heading to our website at www.btbs.ca. While you're there, you can follow us on social, read our blog, and also listen to past episodes. But above all, thank you for committing to moving beyond the bake sale.